for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Unemployment fell to 8.1% as the U.S. added 115,000 jobs in April. Republicans criticized President Obama for using Osama bin Laden in a campaign ad, and 13 people were charged in the biggest criminal case on a hazing death. Joining me for the domestic hour, the Friday News Roundup, Greg Ipp of The Economist, Susan Page of USA Today, and Reed Wilson of National Journal Hotline. You're invited to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday.
Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Greg, let me start with you. The Labor Department reported employers added 115,000 jobs in April. That's the smallest gain in 6 months. But the unemployment rate dropped from 8.2 to 8.1%. How do you explain that?
Well, these numbers were a disappointment. It was the second month in a row that we got job growth well below the 200,000 level. It was a disappointment to people on Wall Street who were expecting something more in the area of 150,000 to 175,000 jobs. The unemployment rate decline was, you know, positive on the surface. It's now come down a full percentage point since last fall. But this was one of those months when it went down for the wrong reason. It didn't go down because more people were working. It went down because fewer people were looking for work. The number of people in the labor force dropped. The number of people now participating in the workforce, either by working or looking for work, is the lowest in decades. It speaks to a very sort of sluggish pace of expansion in the economy. It's not the sign of an economy going back into recession. It is still positive job growth. It's better than we saw a year ago when we had a scare like that. And when you look around, it's hard to find other data that suggests a big problem in the economy. The number of unemployment insurance claims dropped. Factory activity seems to be quite strong. Manufacturing employment was up last month. The stock market has not given up its very strong gains of the year. It may just be that the earlier months when we saw job growth of over 200,000 were a bit exaggerated, perhaps because we had a very warm winter. So it's not that the economy is falling back in a recession, but it's still a very painfully modest pace of growth.
Susan, yeah. How do you see it?
I think let's talk about the politics of it, since Greg's outlined the economics of it. The politics of this is sobering news for President Obama. We had the Alan Krueger, an economic advisor, put out a statement this morning saying it shows the economy is healing. But, you know, it does not feel like an economy that's healing, I think, to most Americans who are all too aware of friends or even themselves being out of work or having trouble finding work or getting so discouraged they don't look for work or having kids coming out of college and I'm unable to find jobs at all.
And Reed Wilson speaking on Fox News just moments after the government reported the job growth, Governor Romney said growth should be triple that amount, that we should be seeing numbers in the 500,000 area. How do you see it?
I think this is a boon to Romney's campaign, to stick with the politics for a moment. When we were talking about foreign policy over the last couple of weeks and Osama bin Laden, the anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death, those were sort of difficult times for the Romney campaign. They couldn't quite figure out how to message around that and how to get on track. Now they get to talk about the economy again, and that's what they want to talk about. You'll notice that in Alan Krueger's statement today, he references the depths of the depression, recession rather, in 2007. You know, the Obama campaign is trying to remind everybody that this was going on when they came into office. Romney's campaign has always said Obama didn't cause the recession, but he made it worse. That is a message that he now gets to drive because these jobs numbers are so disappointing. This comes, by the way, right at a moment when more Americans are trusting President Obama on the economy. His approval ratings on the economy have gone up from, you know, the low 40s or high 30s. 40s into the mid to nearly upper 40s. You know, all that is sort of a positive turnaround. Now here's some sort of soft indicators that suggest he might be in for a bumpier ride than I think he thought.
And, you know, just six more of these monthly job report before people go to the polls and decide who they want to be president. And we know from previous elections that attitudes about whether the economy is getting better or worse get set around this time, in the spring and early summer. And then it becomes really hard for political candidates to change people's minds, even if there's an upturn or downturn when you get very close to election
day. But, you know, it's interesting because there are other economic figures that point in positive directions, Greg.
Well, yeah, sure. So, for example, you know, the manufacturing sector seems to be doing extremely well. Obama has made a big deal about wanting to double exports in 5 years, and we actually seem to be making progress towards that goal. If you're actually in the corporate sector, profits are doing very well. That's one reason the stock market is up so much. And the drop in the unemployment rate has not been trivial, a full percentage point in less than 6 or 7 months. Leaving aside all the wonky reasons why that's a weird development, it's still positive. It's not out of the question that it'll be down to 7.2% by November, which is the highest rate it's ever been, and a president won re-election.
Great.
The interesting, the sort of side note to all that I always bring up is the most important economist in the country, you know, is not at Princeton or Harvard or at some think tank. The most important economist in the country is your neighbor, and how your neighbor feels about the economy is going to drive this election in the long run. Americans' perceptions about the economy were improving, and as Greg pointed out, every indicator suggests that the economy is getting better. Perceptions were getting better as well. However, now over the last month or so, it looks like they may have stagnated. We'll wait to see the next sort of round of polling to see how Americans feel about the jobs. But to get a sense of how they might, just watch the evening news tonight. Just watch how we talk about these numbers as disappointing, as not enough, and, you know, sort of a message that Mitt Romney gets to drive again and bring up these doubts about the economy.
Greg.
And I would add, I have been struck by how sensitive the president's approval ratings have been to the flow of economic news. You know, when job growth picked up and the stock market got off to a roaring start, he opened a very wide lead over Romney in the polls, in the head-to-head polls. And then when gasoline prices spiked up, that lead disappeared. And now it's only about 2 or 3 points. And I think that's intimately related to the very sort of soft tone of some of the economic news lately.
So what President Obama says he's going to do is create summer jobs for youth.
You know, this is interesting. He had an announcement this week where he said he was going to help create about 110,000 new summer jobs in three cities, Philadelphia, Chicago, and San Francisco. A couple interesting things about this. One is that it's something he can just do. He doesn't have to go to Congress to get approval to do this program, to make these partnerships and try to encourage companies and governments, local and state governments, to hire young people or have internships or mentorships. It also is really directed at the age group that is most supportive of him. You know, young people, voters under 30, voted for President Obama 2-1 in 2008. He continues to have disproportionate support among young people. But we also know that that's the age group least likely to go to vote. And the fact that there's a lot of discouraged young people, you know, feeling that the hope that many of them felt with Obama's election 4 years ago has not been realized is making it harder for them to convince these voters to stand up for him, volunteer for him, and go to the polls.
Greg.
On the other hand, there's also, unfortunately, this initiative by the president in some sense actually shows just how impotent he is in terms of having more direct action. He had proposed last fall a $1.5 billion federal fund to directly create these jobs. This fund that he's announced is actually a cooperative thing where all the money is going to come from the private sector, and we frankly have no way of knowing whether they would have created those jobs anyway. So in some sense, given the, you know, difficulty of getting anything done in this Congress, he's sort of left with these initiatives which have perhaps good marketing appeal, but their actual impact is perhaps less obvious.
So you're back to the basic question, how much can President Obama affect job growth?
And the answer is not very much. He, you know, the president always gets too much credit when the economy is going well and too little credit, or rather too much blame when the economy is going the other way. What strikes me at the moment is just how much of an impact, say, somebody like Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, is having on our own elections because of, you know, sort of the troubles in Europe that Germany is spearheading in terms of fixing economies in Spain and Greece and bailing out that which needs to be bailed out. If Europe goes back into a recession and we get dragged down by some of that negative economic activity, then the Europeans are going to have a pretty significant say on our own presidential election.
But look at what's happening in France, where you've got an individual who is saying, this austerity is not what's working, and how that translates to what's happening here in this country, Susan.
You can make the argument that the austerity program that the European countries have followed haven't helped their economy as much as the programs that President Obama has undertaken here. That's certainly an argument that you can make. Now, in a way, it's kind of a tough argument because you're saying things would be worse for President Obama. Things would be worse if we hadn't followed my policies, even though they're not that great right now. But that is an argument you can make by looking at the really treacherous situation some of these European countries face.
So are we going to see the Fed do anything more, Greg?
I think the odds that they do anything more definitely went up today. At his last press conference, Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, was asked, well, what kind of job growth are you expecting? And he said, our forecast looks at something like 150 to 200,000 jobs per month. We've now had 2 months below that level. So whatever the odds were on the Fed doing another money printing operation, or quantitative easing, as the wonks like to call it, they went up today. I don't think we're over the 50% level. I think the Fed would want to see more broad-based evidence of a stalling out in the economy. But it's definitely, finding its way back onto the table.
Do you think that the next meeting of the Fed would do something in that vein?
It might, because by the time of the next meeting, I believe we will have one more employment report.
How do you feel, Susan?
I think it's amazing. The Fed's supposed to be a non-political body, right? And yet look at the big impact it could have on this presidential election. Because if you want to know who's going to win the election, tell us where unemployment and the economy is in October, and we will tell you who will win.
Susan Page, she's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Greg Ip is U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist, author of The Little Book of Economics, and Reed Wilson, editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. I see many of you would like to be part of the conversation. We'll be right back. And I can see that most of you would like to talk about the economy. Here's an email from Carnell in Advance, North Carolina, who says, can somebody please answer Diane's question about Governor Romney's statement that the economy should be creating three times as many jobs? Is this even remotely true? Most reports from economists have forecast that this would be slow. Should Governor Romney be challenged on statements like this, Susan?
Yeah, of course he should be challenged. But in fairness, that is a rate of job growth we've seen in the past when the economy was going strong. Also true, though, that no one predicted that kind of really robust economic growth coming out of this recession.
What do you think, Greg?
Yeah, I mean, adjusted for the size of the population, the last time we saw job growth and a recovery of that level was in 1982-83. And that was the last time we had a recession that was anywhere remotely as bad as this one. But things are very different. First of all, we know from experience in other countries that after a financial crisis, job growth is always very sluggish. And also, there are demographic reasons why the number of jobs are growing more slowly right now. The population is growing more slowly. We're an older population. So the 500,000 number may be what we might have aspired to in a different era. It's simply not realistic now. And yeah, I think the caller is right. Mr. Romney should be sort of questioned about that assumption.
All right. And Reed, there's another accusation being made by Governor Romney, and that is accusing President Obama of politicizing Osama bin Laden's death. What's your reaction?
Well, it's hard to see. It's hard to imagine the White House having taken a bigger victory lap around, you know, around the anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death. Not only were there, you know, primetime TV specials and the cover of Time magazine and sort of new details that get leaked. And remember, a year ago we were assured that they weren't going to leak out new details of the raid. And then President Obama goes to Afghanistan and announces that he's signing an agreement that was already announced. That he's ending the war, and we're also going to be staying there for another 10 years. So sort of trying to placate everybody on this. I think the Romney campaign has a point. This was a politicization. I always screw up that word.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
of a national security moment. Well, look, he gets to do that. You know, Karl Rove had a good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this week where he said essentially President Obama gets credit for authorizing the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. But what the White House might have missed is that sometimes subtlety is a better way to do it. Sometimes things can be oversaid.
Well, let us not forget, mission accomplished.
Exactly.
But adding to that, didn't Governor Romney himself take advantage of the anniversary, Susan?
Well, he did go to a firehouse, part of the 9/11, one of the 9/11 rescues places with former Mayor Giuliani, bringing pizza to firefighters. I think it cannot be a surprise to anybody that President Obama is eager to talk about the death of Osama bin Laden. It's a signature achievement of his first term. And I think if you look at it more broadly, one of the interesting things that's happened in this election is, since the Vietnam War, Democratic presidential candidates have been criticized for being weak on defense. And this is a case where President Obama's standing on this issue, the issue of terrorism, is better than his standing on the issue of the economy. And he has, I think, effectively neutralized this as an issue that can be used against him, with the exception maybe of Iran, when we see what happens with Iran over the next 6 months or so. He's done something kind of fundamental, I think, when it comes to the kind of branding of the parties on this issue.
That's an excellent point. He has done for Democrats on national security what Bill Clinton did for Democrats in the economy, sort of changing the way Americans think about the two parties. Now you take a look at every public opinion survey that's asked this in the last year or so, and more Americans trust Democrats on national security issues than do Republicans. It's just a fascinating change that we've seen.
You know, it always amuses me when people accuse a president of a politicization. I mean, he's a politician. This is what's supposed to happen. I mean, why do you say politics like it's a bad thing? Bush, as you were saying, did exactly the same thing. I mean, during the 2004 election, Dick Cheney was going around saying, if Kerry's elected, we'll get hit again by the terrorists and so on. I think the difference between then and now is that, Obama does poll very well on terrorism and so forth, but it's not the key issue in voters' minds this year the way it was in 2004 when Iraq was turning into a quagmire. And much as the pop that Obama got in the approval ratings when Osama bin Laden was killed faded very quickly, so will any positive feelings associated with the anniversary.
Interesting. Now, it's also fascinating to me that the other GOP nominees who've dropped out of the race have been so slow to endorse Governor Romney, Susan.
You know, it has been interesting. First of all, some of them were pretty slow to get out of the race, even when it was pretty clear that Romney was going to be the nominee. They've been, in some cases, slow to endorse him. And when they have endorsed him, it's been pretty tepid. I predict that what we're going to see over the next months are not the endorsements of Romney by his rivals. We're going to see Democrats running ads that show the criticism that his former rivals made during the primaries. Their attacks on Romney were much fiercer than their defense of Romney is now that they're lining up to endorse him.
These are exactly the same kinds of lines that we heard from the McCain campaign, for example, when they talked about, when they took up Hillary Clinton's mantle that President Obama wouldn't be able to answer the 3 a.m. phone call. I generally think that endorsements are sort of an over-talked-about story. The fact that Rick Santorum hasn't endorsed Mitt Romney is not really going to move a lot of voters. I think in Romney's case specifically, the bulk of his voters will be coming out to vote against President Obama rather than in favor of him. It's just sort of the way the way politics works these days. People have voted in the last four election cycles against the incumbent party, against the person perceived to be in power, rather than for anybody. Even in 2008, people cared more about the change than they did about the hope.
And of course, Newt Gingrich finally decided it was time to get out. What happens to his campaign debt?
Well, he's got over $3 million of it. Now he has some cash on hand that he can use to discharge that. But history tells us that these debts can hang around for a very long time.
Is Mitt Romney going to help out?
Possibly. Certainly that is the Gingrich campaign's hope. Some of the other campaigns still have some debts, but they're not in as bad a situation. Santorum has enough cash on hand to discharge most of his debts, for example.
And Michelle Bachmann did finally come out and endorse him.
She did, after saying during the primaries that Mitt Romney couldn't possibly defeat Obama in the fall. Now she says that she thinks she can. She has about $1 million in debt as well. Gingrich, I think, is in the worst situation in terms of his debt because Rick Perry, no problem. He's the sitting governor of Texas. Michelle Bachmann's out there raising money all the time because she's running for reelection to the House. But Gingrich does not. Gingrich, number one, has a pretty sizable debt, bigger than anybody except John Huntsman. And he doesn't have the kind of incumbent office holding position that encourages donors sometimes to continue to kick in money.
And yet here we are, by the way, this is one of the interesting parts of the Romney campaign to watch. We've got he is spending his first few days as the presumptive nominee standing next to Michelle Bachmann. One of the big commencement addresses he'll give this year is at Liberty University. This tells me that he's still got some work to do, or at least the campaign believes that he's still got some work to do with the social conservative base that has never been terribly trusting of him.
And the dilemma for him, I think, is that every time he does that, speaks at Liberty University, stands next to Michelle Bachmann, he creates problems for himself with his kind of natural base, which is moderate Republicans and independent voters who are, in many cases, alarmed by some of the rhetoric they hear coming out of a place like Liberty University.
It's fantastic to me that Romney's chief foreign policy advisor resigned this week. What happened, Greg?
Well, there's still a lot of mystery about exactly what happened. So the advisor was taken on by the campaign a month or so ago. He had a great history.
This is Richard Grenell.
Right, Grenell. He had came with very strong endorsements from the previous administration where he'd been spokesman for the United Nations. Nobody questioned his loyalty or his very strong credentials in terms of foreign policy. But he came with two bits of baggage, which only sort of became obvious after his hiring. The first was that he had a rather acerbic habit of saying, very off-color things on his Twitter feed about people like Rachel Maddow and Callista Gingrich. The other problem was that he's openly gay, and he has in the past advocated very strongly for the legalization of gay marriage. And as we know, Mitt Romney opposes that. And so immediately some of the conservatives, the very same people that Mitt Romney has struggled with, began to, question the wisdom of having this person as a spokesman. And soon, according to press reports, he found himself sidelined. He wasn't speaking on press conference calls where that was his natural place. And he resigned. Did he jump or was he pushed? We still don't really know. The campaign says they try to talk him out of it, but then the question arises, why did they try and sideline him if, in fact, that is what happened?
In a morning news interview on Fox News, Governor Romney said, "We wanted him to stay with our team." He said his campaign does not discriminate in hiring practice. He said he's a very accomplished spokesperson We select people not based on ethnicity or sexual preference or gender, but their capability. Former Massachusetts governor added that Grinnell had expressed a desire to move on, and he, Governor Romney, wishes him the very best.
You know, I think it's pretty clear he jumped and wasn't pushed. I think the Obama campaign is distressed that they've got this controversy.
You don't mean the Obama.
I mean, the Romney campaign are obsessed, are distressed by how this has played out. But I think Rick Grinnell, according to people close to him, felt that they should have done more publicly to stand up for him when
he
was under attack.
Who was pushing against him?
There were a couple of, I think the guy's name is Brian Fisher, a couple of prominent social conservatives have, you know, went on Fox News, wrote a couple of op-eds for
saying that
Grinnell's involvement in the campaign raised questions about whether or not there would be an advocate for same-sex marriage in the Romney White House. That this somehow signaled the possibility of a change on the issue by Romney himself. There's no indication of that whatsoever. These are people who have this. The chief agitator, by the way, is somebody who has gone negative on Romney's own religion, on Mormonism, calling it anti-Christian frequently. So this is not somebody who is in terribly good with the campaign. But then again, they didn't come out, and as Susan said, they didn't come out and back their own spokesman very much.
So that when you got to foreign policy issues, nobody turned to Grinnell and said, what do you think about this?
Well, that's right. And I think that in Grinnell's mind, that was tantamount to being sort of like pushed out. I think the campaign, reading between the lines, the campaign was just hoping for breathing space to allow this thing to blow over. And in the fullness of time, perhaps Grinnell could have been reintegrated in the way they'd always expected.
Greg, if the Economist editor for The Economist magazine, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, I want to ask you all about this Florida hazing, where you had 13 people criminally charged on Wednesday in the death of a Florida A&M University marching band member. They were not charged with murder. What do you make of it, Susan?
Disappointment to the family. They had hoped for a charge of murder or manslaughter in the death of their son. The prosecutors say that would have been a difficult case to make because there were so many people involved in this horrific scene. I mean, it had a name. It was called Crossing Bus C, and new members of the band would walk down the center aisle of the band bus and be pummeled by more senior members of the band as they walk by. You know, the thing that is very alarming about this is that the Associated Press went back and looked through university records. There have been repeated complaints over a period of years about hazing at Florida A&M and with the band, and the university did not take sufficient steps to address it. These indictments are a warning, a red flag to universities, I think, that they need to take accusations of hazing very seriously.
Hazing and bullying are becoming sort of more widely discussed topics nowadays, which is
thank goodness, a
big documentary that just came out. The focus on it in books and in the media. So it's interesting that this has cropped up now, and yet it's also a sign that we've got this big problem that we simply haven't addressed as a society.
And that poor family losing that young man. And we have another young man in the news this week, a University of California student, Daniel Chong, who was forgotten in a holding cell without food, water, or a toilet for 4 days. I don't even know if he was arrested, Susan.
He was picked up in a drug sweep, but he wasn't charged. He had been told he wasn't going to be charged, he says. And then he was sent back to this holding cell where they apparently forgot him.
This is just mind-blowing. I mean, people in Guantanamo Bay are treated better than this. It's simply appalling. He sounds like he was probably hours away from death when he was eventually found. And so he's suing the Drug Enforcement Agency for $20 million.
There are some details here that are truly hard to understand. or even imagine. He became so desperate, he took a lens from his glasses, broke it, and tried to commit suicide. He was that desperate.
It's incredible, and $20 million probably isn't enough to
So what's the DEA saying?
Their reaction is they forgot. They didn't know. They didn't realize he was there. And look, San Diego, I'm sure, is an area in which the DEA office is probably busier than most. But I can't imagine that it's so busy that they would actually
go
5 days.
How do you put somebody in a room and forget them?
Well, they say they're going to review their procedures. That sounds like an appropriate thing to do. And I'm assuming there'll be repercussions from this. I'm assuming that people will lose their jobs, be reprimanded. I don't know if there'll be other legal repercussions or not. But it is hard to understand how this could happen.
And the other story, still difficult to fathom, is John Edwards. And, of course, the man is on trial. His whole life is really right there out in front of the public.
It is. And this week we sort of veered from the tawdry side of the beginning of his relationship with Rial Hunter to the sort of more at once humorous and yet damning side of how the money to hide her eventual pregnancy was funneled. One of the guy who's on the stand today, Brian Huffman, was the furniture designer, the interior designer who funneled money from this wealthy heiress, Bunny Mellon, through his business and to Rial Hunter. So the Edwards thing is getting worse before it gets better.
Reed Wilson, editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. When we come back, it's your turn. We'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University Washington College of Law, providing a Master of Laws in Advocacy at wcl.american.edu. By EBSCO, supporting libraries with electronic resource discovery and management solutions, journal subscriptions, and EBSCO host databases. And by Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. International news changes too rapidly to wait for the Sunday talk shows. Get insight and analysis from top journalists on the week's most important stories. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Now to your calls. First to Bethany Beach, Delaware. Hi, Ray. How's the weather there today? Hey, Ray, I can't hear you. Can't hear. And let's go to New Orleans. Good morning, Cheryl. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Diane. I love your show, and I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
Okay, my question is this. I keep hearing, due to the low unemployment rate, versus the the unemployment numbers, that people are dropping out and giving up on looking for work. And I'm unemployed myself, and I can't imagine doing that. So my question is this: how do you know? All right, I mean, could people be going back to school? Could does this speculation, or does these numbers include part-time work? Could people be getting part-time work?
It's a good question, Cheryl. I fully agree with the premise. Go ahead, Greg.
It's an excellent question, and often you hear this. When the unemployment rate is going down but there isn't a lot of job growth associated with that, people say, oh, it's because people are discouraged and they're just giving up the hunt for work.
Right.
But in fact, we have ways of measuring that phenomenon. There's sort of an enhanced unemployment rate that counts people who are just not looking for work because they're discouraged, or they're working part-time but they'd rather have a full-time job. But here's the thing, that unemployment rate is falling even faster than the overall unemployment rate. So discouragement cannot explain why it's falling so quickly. The point Cheryl made about going back to school is actually very relevant. A lot of the disappearing workers are college-age people who have apparently decided to stay in college longer or go back to college. Other people are retiring early, and there may also be some older people or other workers who have decided to go on disability, and it may be that they will never come back to the workforce.
Interesting. All right. Thanks for calling, Cheryl, to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Chance.
Oh, hi, Diane.
Hi there.
Yeah, I do like your show very much. Yeah, I hear, Mitt Romney making...
I'm sorry, Chance. I can barely understand you. Would you try to get a little closer to your phone?
Okay. I hear the claim that the country should be doing better. I think he has a point, but it's not Barack Obama's fault. It's the fault of the Republican Party, who is a drag on this country and the people of this country. So we need to remember that.
All right. And that is, of course, a view of a lot of people. Not necessarily the truth, but the view of a lot of people.
One of the more fascinating things that I've read in the last few weeks was an op-ed in the Washington Post over the weekend by Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein.
Who are coming on the program on Monday.
There you go. Tune in on Monday to the Diane Rehm Show. But their argument was it is the Republicans' fault and for their obstructionism, for their sort of moving to the right side of not only the American political spectrum, but their own internal party politics. Whether or not they're completely right. I mean, there's a lot of nuance here that everybody's a little bit to blame for this situation that we're in now. But that's the thing that President Obama is going to try to argue, that he's going to be running against the Republican Congress. He's going to be running against, if they strike down the health care bill, the Republican appointed majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. He'll be and obviously running against essentially George Bush's third term. So whether or not they can actually convince Americans that that the economy is getting better and that Obama is fixing the mess that the last guy made, that's the real challenge.
Greg.
Well, it's an interesting question. Obama has done a lot that probably helped, primarily the stimulus program. And it's true that absent Republican opposition, he probably could have done more. But one of the reasons Republican opposition works is they're often in sync with the people. For example, a lot of economists believe that we could get the economy growing faster if we could take, a couple $100 billion of government money and use it to refinance people who are stuck in mortgages that are too expensive or are worth more than their houses. Glenn Hubbard, who's the principal economic advisor to Mitt Romney, himself has proposed such a plan. But that polls terribly. People hate that idea
because
they think that all those people with mortgages that are too big just got into trouble on their own fault. And why should we, taxpayers who pay their own bills, bail those people out of their own reckless mistakes? So it's easy to say it's Republican opposition, but it's probably more accurate to say it's that the public has no stomach for the kinds of measures that would really make a big difference.
You know, there's another issue out there, and that's Medicare fraud. You have over 100 people charged with trying to defraud Medicare out of $452 million.
Which is a lot of money anyway you count it. You know, one interesting thing about the arrests that were announced this week is that this is a result of Obamacare. These is a result of a program that was set up under the Affordable Care Act that used a computer program to try to identify patterns that might indicate potential fraud in the Medicare program. So the healthcare law has been very controversial, but this is something I think the White House could point to and say, here it's having a really good effect.
I just would like to remind you that people really hate the term Obamacare. They feel it should be rightly referred to as the Affordable Care Act. So, Susan, for future reference.
Yes, you know, but except even with Democrats now, the thing is, it's become the word on about which it's known in short. And even Democrats, even the White House sometimes refers to Obamacare.
Is that right?
It's sort of claiming ownership of something. One of the big problems that the White House had over the health care debate was they totally lost control of the conversation. The Republicans were able to talk about death panels and to talk about restricted care and to sort of define this bill, while the Democrats, President Obama still can't sort of convey what health care does in a soundbite or a bumper sticker or something easily digestible. So by calling it Obamacare themselves, they're claiming credit for something that they may not want. In an ideal world, they may not choose to run a re-election campaign on, but in this world, they certainly have to.
All right, to Reston, Virginia. Good morning, Harvey.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Points I want to make. This hazing business at Florida A&M University, it's a culture in many, unfortunately, black schools. Many parents won't send their children to black universities because of the hazing problem. At Florida A&M, I know for a fact it's been part of their culture for years, and I think the administration should be criminally charged as well. It's something that's gone on. The fraternities are brutalized pledges, and it's unfortunate, but excuse the term, but it's a black mark on a lot of schools, not all of them. And it's something that the press needs to address because it's a well-known fact in the black community about this hazing problem.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. And, of course, it's not just in the black community. It is throughout the university system and high school system and junior high school system. Hazing, bullying occur, and the country needs to do something about it. There are an awful lot of emails talking about retiring the debts. And here's an email from Perry, who says most of these candidates, both Republican and Democratic, who've suspended their campaigns are multimillionaires. Even though legally they're not personally responsible for the campaign debt, I don't understand why they cannot pay off their debt with their own money. Is that legal or not?
It's completely legal. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the debt that John Huntsman's campaign owes, he owes to himself.
I see.
It's loans that the candidate has given to the campaign. There are senators and members of Congress who keep debts to themselves on their books for years on end. As a matter of fact, I think Newt Gingrich is going to be okay in terms of how he pays off this $4 million debt. Remember, Gingrich has this whole web of organizations, nonprofits that we sort of collectively refer to as Gingrich Inc., that he will be able to milk for money over the years. And people, he's got hundreds of thousands of contributors who have given to all these other projects. They'll certainly help retire a debt. He even mentioned one of his newsletters in the speech when he dropped out earlier this week. He mentioned that one of his newsletters was on some subject. Well, those newsletters are coming out
money.
They're coming out of the one of the nonprofit sides, so he's got plenty of revenue that's going to come in.
Susan,
I'm sure Mr. Gingrich hopes what you're saying is true, but he's been, in fact, milking that network for his campaign so far. And I think there's a great difficulty, I think, in getting people to contribute to a campaign that doesn't exist anymore,
right.
Has no chance of succeeding. You know, I remember John Glenn, he ran for president, in 1980?
80.
And he spent, I think, 30 years trying to pay off his debt. Not a man with personal wealth, but doing fundraiser after fundraiser.
Yeah.
And, of course, people max out. You know, your most avid supporters have already contributed all that they can contribute.
All right. Here's an email from Diane in Brick, New Jersey, who says, it was extremely telling that the Romney campaign dismissed or encourage the resignation of foreign policy expert Richard Grenell, now that we're beyond the infighting of the GOP primary. The Romney camp nevertheless bowed to the dictates of the Family Research Council, who objected to Grinnell's homosexuality. Susan?
You know, Diane, that is not my understanding of what happened. I think that the high command at the Romney campaign tried hard to keep Rick Grinnell from resigning. Now, there is, but I think he wanted them to do something more public than urge him privately to stay, and they wanted him to hear more of a defense of him against some of these attacks. And Greg was mentioning the column this morning in the Washington Post by Ruth Marcus, you know, a friend of the News Roundup, saying that people are still waiting for the moment when Mitt Romney will stand up and kind of publicly confront some of the social conservatives and some of the positions at which he's at odds, including this one.
All right, to Manhattan in New York. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick comments. One is, I was listening to radio this morning. The governor of Virginia was taking credit that the state is doing well, and all the other states, they're not doing well. The Republican governor blamed the president. Second, I would like a reporter to ask the Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, in the past 3 years under the Obama administration rules, did he make more money than before or less money than before? Did he pay more taxes than 4 years ago, or he paid less taxes?
Don't know about that, do we?
I don't think we know about that particularly, but what I do think is interesting, he brought up the point about Bob McDonnell, the Republican governor of Virginia, claiming credit for a good economy. Well, take a look at Ohio, Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Nevada, all swing states, all the most crucial states that are going to decide this election. I'll throw Iowa in there, too, all of which have Republican governors. And as the economy gets better, slowly but surely, they're sort of put in this awkward position of claiming credit for themselves while saying that President Obama made it worse, while saying that, you know, George W. Bush might have started the whole thing. It's a very difficult balancing act.
I think the other ironic thing about the governor's comments are that if you actually look at the parts of Virginia that are the most prosperous, it's the northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, which is in no small part due to all the activity going on under the Obama administration.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. To Medford, Oregon. Hi, Barbara.
Oh, good morning, all. Regarding the economy, I just wonder what the Americans expect. I mean, if you drive a car into a wall, you can't get into that car and drive it away. And so the last administration took this economy and drove it over a cliff. So, you get in a car, you drive into a wall, and you wreck it. It's going to take time, and it's going to take money to repair that so you can get back on the road again. And so I just hope that American people have a little more patience, and we invest in this country and get it back on the road.
Barbara, the White House is on the other line. They'd like to line you up to do an ad for them, because that is exactly the case that President Obama is trying to make.
Yes, of course. Greg, do you want to add to that?
Well, I agree with the analogy. We certainly did drive this car over a cliff. What I disagree with is the notion that it was only a Republican president driving that car. I'm sorry, but presidents and voters have been driving that car for decades, this notion that we should all buy houses and it doesn't matter how little money we put down, and people who, can't balance a checkbook, they should, own a home. So the crisis and the recession were, in essence, the consequence of decades of decisions that we as a country made together, not just one administration.
All right, and finally to Tipton, Indiana. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, everyone. Mitt Romney really frustrates me. This stuff about we should be doing three times the job creation that is going on. He can throw out any number that he wants, and there's really no way to prove it. And he does that on a lot of different issues. He throws out these things, and they're almost unbelievable. I basically think that Mitt Romney is a fraud, and I hope the country realizes that.
It's interesting that you've got this sense that, on the one hand, people say, why aren't more jobs being created, and then you've got a candidate throwing out 500,000 and Bob's, people buy into it.
Bob's got a point. There are numbers that that we can all just sort of throw out there and talk about how much we'd like it if these things were happening. But the bottom line is, and going back to Barbara's point, the bottom line is Americans are not patient. We are not a patient people. We want things done now. We want the economy fixed now. There's no, with just 2 years, just 2 years into the administration, the electorate delivered a stinging rebuke on the Obama administration for essentially not having fixed the economy, for focusing on other things first. But, 2 years is not enough time to turn around one of the worst recessions in American history. So,
Susan.
And if Mitt Romney gets elected in November, he'll be faced with the expectation he's set that under his administration, we will see that kind of robust job growth.
And frankly, his hypothetical, job numbers that we should be having register as little with the voter as Obama saying, look at how bad it would have been if I didn't have these policies. It's exactly what Reid said earlier on the show. The one economist whose opinion really matters is the voter himself. He knows with his own lying eyes whether the economy is doing better. And we have seen relatively modest rates of job growth manifest themselves in a better mood in the country and better numbers for the president.
Well, we shall see. Greg Ipp, he is with The Economist magazine. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Reid Wilson, Editor-in-Chief of National Journal Hotline. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurov-Livker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from